Legal Matters.
Brett Bentley is my guest, founder and CEO of Bentley Attorneys. Brett, thank you so much for joining us this evening. I really appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you, Aubrey. Thank you very much for inviting me onto your show.
So one of the things that I've been thinking about is the legality, I suppose, the legality of a computer-generated agreement where somebody is far off, and the way that we've been doing it is I'd get the document on a PDF document, I'd sign it, rescan it, and resend it. What is the status legally of that kind of document in as far as contracts are concerned?
Obviously, in the last year, particularly year and a half with the whole COVID lockdown, we've seen a surge of companies that used to do things, well, sort of old school and get the documents signed and in person, and that's the way they contracted. And they've had to now adopt the approach that's slowly been creeping into business of, you know, sending a PDF through on an email, getting it printed on the other side and sending it back. And the question has been from these companies and some, you know, large contracts has been, is this valid? And yeah, the law does cover this. We've got an act in South Africa, Electronic Communications and Transactions Act of 2002, which governs this and does, in most instances, make these type of contracts legally binding, obviously depending on the circumstances of how it's done. It can be very tricky because if you think about it, we're not only talking about a digital agreement here. We're talking about something that, you know, starts out as a physical document, as you said in your intro. They get scanned, get signed on the other side, get scanned again, and then gets emailed back. You know, it's changing form all the time. But fortunately, the law is starting to catch up with technology. Technology's always far ahead of it, but it's starting to catch up. And if it's done correctly, a signed PDF document is a binding agreement, except for certain exceptions, which I'll chat about in due course.
So let me just be clear: the act that we're talking about at the moment that covers issues of electronic documents is the ECTA Act. The Electronic Communications and Transaction Act, number 25 of 2002. What does it stipulate? I mean, how does it admit in law a document that I've just described, where, you know, a PDF document has been sent to me, I signed it, rescanned it, sent it. Does it admit that kind of document as admissible evidence in a dispute?
Yes, well, it doesn't specifically mention PDF by name in terms of the contract. It refers to a data message. So the big question then was, is the PDF a data message because of these changing forms? And fortunately, a number of cases have had to have a look at this whole situation of PDF contracting through email and have come to the conclusion that, yes, it is a data message, even though it does change form from physical to data to physical and back and forth, that it ultimately is a data message. So that has created a degree of certainty for us in that we at least know that we are dealing with a data message when we're dealing with a PDF. And then the question, comes in about signatures and how they applied and the legalities of that.
Give us a call, 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. Have you found yourself in some sort of legal entanglement because a document that was generated digitally but signed by both parties manually and then reduced to a PDF again and then rescanned? Have you been in a situation, I call it the legal entanglement, where perhaps the document wasn't accepted as such, as a legally binding document? And how did all of those things pan out ultimately? Did you have to compromise at some level? Did you have to compromise on issues of terminology because it was understood what the meaning was, what you meant to be doing. Does that ever happen, Britt, where people will compromise, not necessarily because the letter of the law says something, but because there's a gentleman's understanding that we agree with each other, this is what you meant, and I'm happy to accept that. Does that happen quite often?
You know, originally there was a great deal of uncertainty about, you know, whether, for example, if a signature is required, whether or not, you know, putting your signature on the document amounted to an electronic signature, because the Electronic Communications Act refers to two forms of electronic signature, a normal electronic signature and then an advanced electronic signature. Now, the question was, what was required? Was it this advanced electronic signature, or was the simple signing on a PDF good enough? And fortunately, the simple form of signature has now been accepted in normal contracts, that you just need to sign it in that form, and that it is acceptable. Because, you know, for most of us coming from the analog world, physical signatures are what we know. We've grown up in a world where that's the way you do things, and now all of a sudden, you know, even since the introduction of the Electronic Communications Act, that's 20 years ago, technology is advancing at rapid rate, and the law's trying to catch up with it, and it's just starting to. It's recognized that. So, for example, there was a situation where two parties had an agreement which said that they would only be able to vary it or cancel it,
yeah,
if that was reduced to writing and signed by both parties. Now, you had two directors communicating via email with the normal email signature that we all have at the bottom of our email.
Yeah.
And the question was that an electronic signature? And fortunately, went all the way to the Supreme Court of Appeal, and fortunately, they said, yes, that is an electronic signature. So, you know, we've also got to be careful in what we're doing and how we're conducting ourselves in email, because it can very much be a binding contract on us. You know, it doesn't have to be reduced and physically signed. You know, the Supreme Court of Appeal, second highest court in the land, has said that an exchange of emails with email signatures was binding.
Let me take some calls. Teboho is in Benoni. Hi, Teboho. What is your question for Brett?
Hi, Operanakis.
Yeah.
The question that I have, you might have touched on this while I'm outside. You'll just let me know. When it comes to electronic digital signature, as it's called, how do they authenticate their real one? Because my one looks far different. It's completely different than my actual signature.
Mm.
And as a follow-up question, how do they actually deal with scamsters or forgery? How do they distinguish between your actual signature and your digital signature?
Which is, I suppose, the biggest
case of a dispute.
Absolutely. Let's see what Brett has to say. Brett?
Good question.
Brett?
Yes, hi.
Go ahead.
Good question there. Yeah, brilliant question, because, you know, in the old days when we were doing physical signatures and binding and that, we would bring a handwriting expert to court, and they would sort of feel on the paper and see whether there was a lump and a bump and compare it to previous signatures and ultimately come to the conclusion whether or not it was the person's signature. Now we move into the world of digital, and we it's no more handwriting experts. We're having to get technology people involved in there, and data analysts and people that analyze the electronics of it. So, as I said, there's two forms of signature. If we're looking at the normal electronic signature, and hopefully I'll get on to chatting about an advanced electronic signature, but if we just look at a normal electronic signature, there hasn't yet, as far as I've seen, been any case reported where a person has disputed that. So we've still got to open the can of worms where somebody comes along to court and says, look, that wasn't my signature, or that scanned version of my signature wasn't administered by me. It was administered by somebody else, and it was part of a fraud that was involved. And yet, the digital experts involved to see the evidence, and that's what it's going to come down to. It's going to be a question of evidence comparing the probabilities of that being a fraud or not. So it would basically be using the digital expertise together with the Electronic Communications Act and using the law of evidence and combining those to look at the probabilities of you being the actual signatory of that particular electronic document.
One of the things you said, Brett, was the fact that, you know, technology is always ahead of our laws, right?
Yes.
You know, technology is always leaps and bounds ahead of our laws, and we find ourselves conventionally behaving in ways that are more technologically friendly than perhaps our laws have caught up to.
Yes.
What are our laws doing to diminish the gap between the law and, you know, the technological situation?
Well, the only thing it can do is adapt to the times. So, you know, as I said, we're 20 years after the introduction of the Electronic Communications Act. There's been lots of calls to amend it, to take cognizance of all of the new technology that's been out and since this act was passed through Parliament. So I think that is probably one of the main ways that the law can catch up, is to be amended and be changed, to meet the technology. Because, you know, as I said, the courts are taking baby steps in terms of dealing with these. I mean, we only tonight, when we're only chatting about exchange of PDF documents, yeah. I mean, we go into the online environment and it's a whole different kettle of fish with not a single reported case dealing with, you know, the typical way that we do an online transaction, buying a, you know, a book of Takealot or whatever the case may be. So, you know, that's the thing. The courts and the law have just got to advance and take cognizance of the new ways of contracting. And, you know, in 5 years' time, I don't know. I mean, it's not particularly my area, but, I mean, we might need new legislation to deal with cryptocurrency transactions or the likes of those.
And you say not one case study has hit the courts at this stage. Are we likely to see, as I suppose people get more and more fair with the laws, become more and more comfortable with the transition between, shall we call it, terrestrial law towards virtual law? Are we likely to see more and more cases emerge, Brett?
Absolutely. And you know, unfortunately, it also involves, you know, how far matters go in courts involve how much you're being sued on or suing on. So these transactions that we began to see, I mean, these cases that we've began to see involve transactions which are PDF and involve large amounts of money. So as these type of transactions involved on online get greater value, so the chances of us seeing more cases in court will increase. So the latest sort of development of cases at the end of last year was looking at things like, as you mentioned in your intro, suretyships. So, for example, the suretyship law that deals with suretyships,
yes,
is that it has to be in writing and it has to be signed. The same type of legislation applies to Alienation of Land Act, which applies to, you know, you and I buying a property. So, again, it has to be in writing and it has to be signed. And this is where the advanced electronic signature comes into being, because those type of transactions, the Electronic Communication and Transactions Act says that they have to use an advanced electronic signature.
Yes.
Now, the problem is, in a practical terms, is getting these advanced electronic signatures and getting them authorized, because currently in South Africa, there's only two authenticating organizations, the Post Office and a private company called Law Trust. But in order to do it, the standard has been set so high that they have to send somebody to you to do a face-to-face interview before they will confirm your advanced electronic signature. Now, if you've got an advanced electronic signature, that fraud that we discussed earlier wouldn't come into play, because that's how advanced these type of signatures are. But the thing is, you know, I mean, from a practical point of view, if I'm busy with my business and I go through to the bank and I say I want to take an overdraft, and they say, fine, we'll give you your business the overdraft, but we want you to sign a personal suretyship on that. It's actually easier for me to go into the bank and physically sign the document than for them to send out somebody, authenticate me, issue me with an advanced digital signature, and then me to go ahead and sign that particular document. The same with the property deal.
Yeah.
You know, if you're doing a one-off property deal, it's not all of us sort of buy and sell properties on a daily basis. It's a rare occasion that we're doing that. So it's not something that you're going to go to the extent of getting an advanced digital signature.
Yes.
So that's the bit where perhaps the law has just got to advance a little bit more to catch up with technology and catch up with it. Maybe we'll get to a stage where we all sort of go off to the post office or something and get advanced digital signatures, and they sit with us for life or until the next technological revolution or something. But at the moment, it's not a very easy or practical thing to do to get an advanced electronic signature.
Give us a call. Have you perhaps gone through the process of getting an electronic signature? What was the process? Are you finding that people that you do business with are ready for this virtual world? It can be frustrating, I would imagine, Brett, if you are the only one that is au fait with some of these laws, these requirements, and people are still behaving very much in the analog way. It can be frustrating.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think everybody is wary, and as you rightly pointed out, you know, they don't want to end up in a situation where they get an agreement signed and then end up going to court at the end of the day and it's an unenforceable agreement, which could, in fact, and it has, in fact, happened in a number of cases where people have emailed a PDF suretyship agreement. The person signed it with a scanned version of their signature, sent it back, and it was tried to be sued on, and it was unsuccessful. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, people are very wary of the unknown.
Let's take a call from Julie in Cape Town. Good evening, Julie. What's on your mind?
I think I completely agree with you guys. I think we're definitely in a digital era where, you know, large organizations are forcing analog sort of engagement with, you know, I think the country's already suffered large death rates, and, you know, these people are working from home, you know, and people are losing family members. I myself lost my dad in August this year, and just trying to assist my mom, you know, moving his pensions over, it's a tremendous impact that's hits the country. And, you know, I'm one of 800,000 people that are impacted by the current era we're in.
Yeah.
And you know, we're talking to huge organizations saying, guys, we're in a digital era. And unfortunately, you know, I work in a industry where I work with banks. Today you can open a bank account with Discovery using facial recognition. So there's no ways. Using cryptography is ways of, you know, and I'm just jumping here, but, you know, using cryptography today is ways of identifying yourself. You can do digital signing and documentation. I think when you fill in a document, you type it out, it's clearer. It's visually, you can't make any mistakes or understanding whether you've actually, you know, you're literally typing it out, so it can't be better than that. You know, and just using my dad's incident as an example, you know, you've got to go in for affidavits. You've got to have, you've got proof of death. You've got these various items, like you're saying, the weight of probability. And I can't understand how institutions, and I'm meaning big institutions, insurance and so forth, that are saying, guys, please, you know, put stuff in an envelope or come and hand deliver it to us. Mm. And it's very difficult. So I have my mom in Johannesburg. I'm sitting in Cape Town. And you're trying to sort out these sort of things. And you think that with the technology we've got in our hand and we've got grasp to, you know, if you just use some sort of financial, if you look at the financial industry, you know, you've got exactly that for general purpose as well. So I can't see why organizations, large giant organizations, aren't using cryptography, hardware security modules for general purpose digitalization for the country. And this is a global problem. I'm just not sure if this is in South Africa only.
Julie in Cape Town, thanks very much for your call. Britt?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Some very valid points. I mean, we talk about affidavits and proof of evidence and that type of thing. And yeah, I think that the bigger organizations and the institutions, when it does involve something that involves signatures and requires a proof of evidence, and it involves something very important like, you know, winding up an estate or something like that, they are still erring on the side of caution in terms of the way that things are found and the way that things are authenticated until we get more certainty in certain aspects of the law.
I get the law and the level of certainty we need, and that's critically important. I hear that. But I mean, I remember a time when, you know, we'd use your thumbprint, and the thinking behind that was that it's a unique signature form. Nobody else has your thumbprint. And then, of course, we moved, as we got more educated and so forth, we moved to the signature. And again, as you said, that you could still bring in writing experts to check whether or not and to authenticate whether that signature belongs to the person who claims to have been the signatory on the contract.
Right.
And I know that there's all sorts of interesting things out there, firewalls and encrypted. But what are the chances? I mean, maybe I should ask the question this way. It seems, Brett, that it is easier to forge a digital signature than perhaps some of the more less sophisticated things. And I'm speaking here as somebody who is very, very lay to technology and all of those kinds of things. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I tend to agree. You know, I mean, if we're looking at it at its most base level, if we're looking at pure electronic signatures, you know, a simple exchange of emails being held by the Supreme Court of Appeal as a binding contract. Fortunately for the party for the parties in that case, neither of them disputed the exchange of correspondence between them in terms of the emails. But it is going to get to that stage where somebody does turn up to court and say, no, well, actually, I didn't send that email. Somebody hacked my email account and sent that email. Or, you know, that isn't my that looks like my signature, but it was, you know, was scanned off one of the documents in my office. I wasn't a party to it. And yeah, at that most base level of basic electronic signatures, the vulnerabilities are there, and how we limit that, I suppose, is by developing the advanced electronic signatures, you know, which gets into the technological world of digital certificates and the same sort of criteria that we use in our digital banking. That sort of level of security.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose if the levels of security are at best in people's perception still questionable, right? Maybe if we had more technically savvy people who'd be able to tell us about the impenetrability of technological, I mean, electronic signatures. If they were to be able to explain all of that to us, we'd probably be more comfortable. But the very fact that the perception exists that perhaps the electronic signatures might be more easily forged, what does that do to the integrity of the document, of the surety document, of the contractual document? What does that do if the perception, Brett, is is still a little fluid?
Yeah, well, look, Section 15 of the Electronic Communications Act says that if you put up a certificate, so if example, you and I enter into an agreement, and I'm the party that's relying on the agreement, and I want to institute action against you in terms of that agreement, I would have to put up a certificate to state how that contract came into being and why I can't produce the original and explain why it's the original. Now, that would serve as basic proof of that document being a valid document. But you could come back and produce evidence to show that you weren't a party to it for whatever reason, that I've perpetrated some fraud on you or something to that effect. So they're trying to create, the legislature is trying to create a degree of certainty because it is the normal way of contracting. It's becoming the norm as opposed to, the exception or the way that we do things when we being Harry casual about contracting, it is becoming more and more the absolute norm. And there has to be a degree of certainty there.
I'll read you a message from Dr. Olu in Pretoria, a very good friend of the show's, who has very often helped me understand certain legal principles just by being able to throw some wisdom my way. David, though, is in Pretoria. Hi, David.
How are you, Dobza?
Yeah, go ahead, man. Go ahead. What's
I'm currently on my side working for one of the biggest life insurers, man.
Yeah.
We do not accept electronic signed documents at this point. Because life insurance, and personally as well, it's a sensitive issue to observe. But you're going to send me a beneficiary update with an electronic signed document. 2 years later, you can query that saying that you did not sign that. It can stand. And one of the things that we have noticed that, yes, with your medical and bank and whatnot, those things can be accepted. But with life, on our side, basically, if I receive a document like that, what I do is we go back to the original document. Because originally, sometimes, 5 years ago, you did not sign with, you signed with a pen. And if a pen and that document do not match, I will call you and advise you, Dobza, I need you to sign on a blank page 10 times. If I'm still not happy, what I'm going to do, I'm going to send it to forensics. And then the forensics tell me not, because we've seen a lot of fraud, especially when it comes with the life policy, whereby people can just try and they have succeeded sometimes, but sometimes they fail. And a lot of times you end up finding, they tell you that now you open up a policy, 15 years later, but you don't remember that. Someone opened that on your behalf because of what? Because of such document. Because this thing it's a stamp. Anybody can get hold of.
So what has your company been doing, David, during this time, this COVID-19 time?
Okay. During the COVID-19, it was a good one. Yeah. They were accepting those documents, but they would we would verify them, not just a little, but we would scrutinize it.
Yeah, yeah.
Until we give you a call, up until we decide not. I even give you a call, Dobza. Do you remember signing a document like this?
Yes.
It's recorded. And then if you say yes, then it's yes. But most of the time you say, no, I don't remember. And then that's when,
So even that conversation, David, would be part of, I suppose, the arsenal of weaponry, of weapons that you guys have in the event that a dispute would arise.
Exactly.
David, in Pretoria.
Personally as well, I don't think it's for now, they should accept it.
Yeah, yeah. Unless, of course, they raise the profile of the authentication process, yeah?
Exactly.
David in Pretoria, thanks very much for your call. Brett, I mean, here's David, works for a reputable insurance company, says, you know, they're a bit nervous about digital signatures and that sort of thing. Is that what you're finding in your experience?
Yes, but as I said, the more serious the document, obviously, the more concerned people are about the legitimacy of it. And it's interesting, you know, that he mentions voice there, because the Electronic Communications Act actually describes a data message as meaning a voice, where the voice is used in an automated transaction. So, you know, that's where technology, the edge of technology is getting to things like voice biometrics.
Yeah.
Where if you're involved in a contract and they analyze your voice and they can show that it's your voice, that can be a validly binding, you know, agreement. So they're looking at many different ways to try to secure particularly these top end type of contracts as opposed to, you know, your day-to-day contracts that involve more sophisticated types of technology.
Dr. Olu is a cyber law consultant, and he sends me this message. He says, "Dear Aubrey, a broad or implied interpretation of the scope of electronic signature has the following characteristics. A, an individual is uniquely linked to the communication. B,
right.
The communication is capable of identifying that user in that manner. C, a signature is created using means that can be maintained under the sole control of the user. D, will be linked to the data message to which it relates in such a matter that any subsequent change of data or data message is detectable. And finally, E, is based on the face-to-face identification of the user." Would you concur with Dr. Olu?
Yeah, in basic terms, I think that is correct. If we look at the guideline that was released by the Department of Public Service and Administration in February 2019, electronic signature guidelines, they sort of, in terms of basic electronics, said that they need only one positive act requirement in supporting evidence are electronic signatures, data attached to, incorporated, or logically associated with other data which is intended by the user to serve as a signature. Electronic signatures include digitalized and digital signatures. They then go on to define digitalized signatures as a digital reproduction of a handwritten signature.
Yeah.
For example, fax signature, picture of a signature, or a signature captured tablet. And then the other types that we touched on there is biometric signatures, which is generally a description of electronic signatures made with a biometric body measurement, such as you mentioned, you know, fingerprint, acting as the authenticating or acceptance. And then the fourth one that they recognized, MD, is a one-time, you know, as we know in our banking world, the one-time password, the OTP token, is a security device or software program. And that's just a guideline that's been given by government in 2019. But on the whole, I agree completely with the doctor there on what he said.
I suppose in very broad terms, Brett, what we're faced with is what the whole world is faced with, and that is to try and create a seamless integration of the digital world into the world that we've grown accustomed to, and I'll call it the analog world, for lack of a better term. I think at this stage, that is our biggest challenge. And it's not going so well, Brett?
I think, look, it's not going as fast as we would maybe like it to go, but yeah. I think we are moving in the right direction. There's some tweaks that need to be done in the law to catch up a bit. But I think that, you know, events like this, which have forced us to contract in ways that we haven't contracted before, you know, necessity is the mother of invention.
Yep.
And I think we're going to see some changes fairly shortly.
Yeah, and it will become the norm, I suppose, at some point. In the very near future, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely.
Brett Bentley, it's been great talking to you. How do people get in touch with you if they want to understand these issues a little bit better? But if they've got a real case that they'd like for you to get involved in, how do they get in touch with you?
I think either pop across to our website. It's bentleylaw.co.za. Yep. And they'll find all our contact details on there.
Brent, thanks so much for giving us this information. We really appreciate it and hope we talk sometime soon again.
Thanks for chatting to me, Aubrey. All right. Thanks to your listeners.
Much appreciated.